Well, welcome everyone. This is Dr. Hedberg, and welcome to the Dr. Hedberg Show. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking about the best thyroid diet. I actually did a webinar with Hawthorne University, I think it was last year, on the best thyroid diet. So that's a video on YouTube that you can find pretty easily if you search for the best thyroid diet. And I cover a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk about today. Probably get into a little bit more of the research on that webinar because it's for the Hawthorne nutrition students. But this should be sufficient for most people who are interested in this topic. So the first thing to note is just that the best thyroid diet is really not that much different from the best diet for anybody, no matter, you know, what condition they have or if they're healthy. So, but we are going to talk about just a few important things that you should really know about regarding, you know, things to look out for that can really negatively affect your thyroid function. And we'll talk about some strategies and things like that. So the first thing I wanted to mention is blood sugar. And so blood sugar is intimately connected with the adrenal glands, which, as you know from reading my material and listening to these podcasts, the adrenal glands are intimately connected with the thyroid. And I did do a podcast on the thyroid adrenal pancreas axis. And so that's just talking about the thyroid and the adrenal glands and blood sugar and how they all interact. And so just to kind of recap, if one of those is off, then the other two are probably going to be off as well. So whenever you get a surge of blood sugar, like from sugar or carbohydrates or high glycemic carbohydrates, you get an increase in glucose in the blood and you get an increase in insulin. And that increase will inhibit thyroid function. And then it will also stress the adrenal glands. And then, as you know, when the adrenal glands are stressed, then the thyroid will be out of balance as well. So that's the first thing to note is blood sugar. And the way that you keep your blood sugar stable is by eating a high-quality protein with each meal. And you can just use your hand to measure how much protein you're eating. And so one palm-sized portion of protein is going to be plenty for most people. If you're a man and you're lifting a lot of weights, exercising a lot, then you might want to do two palm sizes of protein. But for women, a one palm-sized portion is going to be enough. So that'll be, you know, like a chicken breast, for example, or like a turkey burger. That sort of size is sort of what you're looking at. And that'll give you anywhere from 25 to 35 grams of protein just from that one piece of protein. So that's number one to help your blood sugar. Number two is eating vegetables with every meal. And then number three, if you are going to eat carbohydrates, then they want to be low glycemic carbohydrates. And so low glycemic carbohydrates basically don't have a significant impact on your blood sugar. So it's going to keep your insulin levels low and your blood glucose levels low. And just a few examples of low glycemic carbohydrates would be something like brown rice, wild rice, sweet potatoes, quinoa. All of the legumes will be low glycemic, like beans and lentils. So those are some of the most popular ones that really tend not to spike blood sugar too much. And there's also low glycemic fruits, which are okay. And those are mainly going to be the berries, like blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, and things like that. And then you do want to have just a healthy amount of fat with each meal. The best fats are going to be like olive oil, coconut oil, butter, ghee. Those are going to be some of the best ones out there, and you always want to get a variety. So that's just kind of some basics. You know, we're not going to get into a tremendous amount of detail in keeping your blood sugar stable, but you just, again, you just want to avoid too many carbohydrates, and you want to avoid high glycemic carbohydrates. So some high glycemic carbohydrates would be like white rice or white potatoes or certain types of pasta. There's going to be high glycemic fruit, and then everything else is just pretty obvious, like pancakes and crackers and bread and things like that. Okay, so the next thing is protein. So the thyroid requires a lot of protein. So does your metabolism. And the amino acid leucine, that's L-E-U-C-I-N-E, is required for thyroid hormone production. Leucine is a branched chain amino acid, along with isoleucine and valine. And branched chain amino acids are very popular among athletes, and they help with performance and building muscle and recovery. But they're also really important for metabolism. So leucine, I usually have patients buy leucine powder, and they add a scoop of leucine powder to their protein shakes. And then if you're using a very high quality whey or protein powder, leucine should be either number one or number two, the highest amino acid content of all the amino acids in the protein. And that's how you can kind of tell if it's a good protein powder or not. The leucine content should be higher, but that will also increase the price of the powder. So cheap powders will have moderate to low amounts of leucine, and that's because it's just cheaper to make. So you do get what you pay for. So look for a good leucine content. And so with protein, like I mentioned with the blood sugar, you know, one or two palm-sized portions. If you're doing protein shakes, add the leucine powder to the shakes. And that's really all you need to know about protein and the thyroid. And what the research is showing now is that the elderly, once you get up, you know, into the 60s and up, it's been shown that those people need 25 to 35 grams of protein with each meal, and that's to maintain healthy muscle mass. That's a pretty good target for most people, but if you want to do a calculation, your minimum daily protein intake would be 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. So you just take your body weight in pounds and you divide it by 2.2, and that gives you your body weight in kilograms, and then just multiply that number times 0.8, and that'll give you your absolute minimum daily protein intake. So again, that's the minimum, but some people need more, sometimes 1 gram per kilogram body weight, sometimes 1.2 grams per kilogram. And then 1.5 grams per kilogram is really the max that the vast majority of people need. And again, that's for athletes or people who are exercising a lot. So that's just a simple calculation you can do. The next thing is your pH. And there's a lot of confusion out there about pH and the so-called alkaline diet. I just want to be clear that with the alkaline diet or alkalizing your body, whatever you want to call it, you're not actually alkalizing the body. You're just getting yourself out of an acidic pH. So it's called metabolic acidosis. And this has actually been studied quite a bit in the literature. A number of good papers actually are out of Switzerland, where they did measurements of thyroid hormone and adrenal hormones and growth hormone in people who were very acidic and people who had chronic acidosis. And they actually found that if you're acidic, the TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone, will actually increase. So it'll make you look like you're hypothyroid. And then the free T4 and the free T3 actually decrease if you're acidic. So it does have a direct impact on thyroid function and your tests as well. The other thing that they found is that it increases cortisol levels. if you're very acidic for a long time. And so, as you know, when cortisol levels go up, that also negatively impacts thyroid function. And then the third thing they found is that growth hormone levels drop if you're acidic. So it behooves you to be aware of your pH. And I usually just recommend a first morning urine pH test with Hydrion pH paper. And test your pH for 5 days in a row in the first morning urine catch. And you want to throw out the high and the low number and average the middle three. And that'll give you, again, it's kind of a crude measurement, but it will give you a general idea of where you are. And really, you want to be at least at 6.4. And anywhere between 6.4 and 7.4 is going to be fine. If you're below 6.4, then you're probably acidic. And then if you're above 7.4, it is possible to be too alkaline. So you do want to be careful that you're not too alkaline either, because that can actually indicate that your body's breaking down. So if you are acidic, you just need to decrease your consumption of acidic foods. So gluten-containing grains are very acidic. Too much protein is going to be acidic. So and too little protein will make you acidic, actually. So you want the right balance there. As long as you follow those protein guidelines you talked about, you should be okay with that. But usually what contributes to the acidosis is stress is really a big one. Not sleeping well, insomnia, work stress, relationship stress, emotional stress, all those things will make you more acidic pretty quickly. Exercising too much, and then too many acidic foods. Grains are really the big ones as far as being acidic. And then the alkaline foods are all plant-based. So vegetables, fruits. There are some gluten-free grains that are alkaline. So for example, gluten-free oats are actually alkaline, as an example. And so you want to be eating about 60 to 80% of your plate would be alkaline foods. So again, mostly vegetables or low glycemic fruits. And then you want to have a good protein source. And that should usually do it. If you need more help, then magnesium supplementation will make you less acidic. Potassium bicarbonate supplementation will make you less acidic. So those are some of the big ones that are really helpful with pH. And again, your free T4 and free T3 levels will be lower if you're very acidic for a long time. And again, your TSH might be higher than normal. The next thing I wanted to just briefly mention is goitrogens, because this is something that's kind of circulating around the internet. There's a lot of confusion there. Now, too much of any food is going to be bad, no matter what it is. It will negatively affect you somehow. So eating goitrogens, and goitrogens are basically foods that contain compounds that inhibit iodine transport into the thyroid. That's really what they do. And so too much inhibition of iodine can create hypothyroidism. But you would have to be eating massive amounts of raw goitrogens on a daily basis to even begin to see any negative effect on the thyroid gland. Most of those studies are done on animals, and there just aren't any good studies that show that moderate consumption of goitrogens negatively impacts the thyroid. So goitrogens are things like some of the brassica vegetables like broccoli and Brussels sprouts and kale. And there's a whole list of goitrogens, and they're all extremely healthy foods that actually contain compounds that actually enhance thyroid function. So you would lose out on all the health benefits of foods like broccoli and kale and things like that if you follow this fanatical, dogmatic movement on the internet talking about how bad goitrogens are. It's just a lack of understanding of the science. So again, I will grant you that eating goitrogens in their raw state and eating a lot of them at every meal will have a mild negative effect on thyroid function, but no one in their right mind is doing that. Also, if you cook the goitrogens, lightly cook, steam, saute, that really neutralizes a lot of the goitrogenic activity. So again, unless you're eating massive amounts in their raw state, you just don't need to worry about them. Soy is also considered a goitrogen, but again, soy is not really a great food, just in general, for health. And it is a goitrogen. If it's fermented, like if it's in the form of miso or tempeh, then it has very minimal goitrogenic activity. So again, if you're downing large amounts of tofu and chugging, you know, soy milk all day and stuff like that, then yeah, it might start to affect your thyroid. But again, you know, no one should be doing that. And again, it's just not something to worry about. The next thing is your carbohydrate intake. Now, this is really interesting. The studies show that if you eat less than 50 grams of carbohydrates a day, then thyroid function begins to slow down. Most specifically, you'll see lower levels of T3, and reverse T3 levels may increase. So this does happen on the ketogenic diet, but there is research that shows by, say, Dr. Volek has studied this a lot, the effects of low carbohydrate diets and ketogenic diets on hormones. And so there is an adaptation, and so your body will adapt. So I won't worry about that too much, but if you're on a very low carb diet or ketogenic diet and you are feeling kind of sluggish or cold, eating carbohydrates can quickly kind of kickstart the thyroid and warm you up. So that's just something you can sort of watch on your own if you start to feel sluggish and cold. Just getting your carbs up above 50 grams a day can start to kickstart that. So you might need to get up to 100 grams or 150 grams to really get things going. And that's what that's popular right now is these carbohydrate cycling diets and ketogenic cycling diets where you eat very low carbs for, say, 5 or 6 days, and then you eat a massive amount of carbohydrates, like 150, 200 grams. And people are doing that to prevent the thyroid from slowing down. It kickstarts the metabolism because our bodies are designed always to survive and conserve energy. And burning fat is much more efficient than burning carbohydrates. And that's why your body shifts into ketosis when you're on low carbs or not eating a lot. But again, the metabolism can suffer in those cases. It really depends on the individual. But those types of cycling diets and those carbohydrate surges are just too difficult for many people to stick with. And so just be aware of that. Checking your carbohydrate intake, if it is below 50, then that explains why you might just not be feeling all that great on the low carb or keto diet. And just eating more carbs can really kickstart things. The next thing is gluten, and this is mainly related to Hashimoto's and Graves' disease. So gluten is going to be more of an irritant to autoimmunity. Very difficult for many people to digest. It can create inflammation, not just in the gut, but outside of the gut. In fact, about 60% of the negative effects of gluten happen outside of the intestine. So the brain, the thyroid, the heart, the joints, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And some people just can't digest it well. They're intolerant to gluten. Only 2% of the world's population has celiac disease, which is a true autoimmune disease that requires, you know, 110% avoidance of gluten. But if you're gluten intolerant and your gut heals and you're feeling healthy, then moderate amounts of gluten are going to be okay. And I did do a webinar or a YouTube video on gluten and Hashimoto's disease, where I talk about a lot of the reasons why not everyone with Hashimoto's has to be gluten-free forever for their entire lives. So that's just something to be aware of. But if you do have Hashimoto's or Graves' disease, then most of the time, vast majority of the time, you want to be 100% off of gluten while you're going through your healing process. So that could be 6 months, 12 months, a year and a half. And again, once you get healthy, that's when you talk to your doctor about, you know, reintroducing it or seeing if you even can reintroduce gluten. I do get into a tremendous amount of detail in my book, The Complete Thyroid Health and Diet Guide. That's available on Amazon.com, and it's going to be on the shelf at most Barnes and Nobles. But I've got much more detailed information in there about all these different diet strategies. And then the second half of the book is 150 thyroid healthy recipes. And those recipes are designed to be gluten-free, and they're designed to have good quality protein. And then they also are low glycemic. And then I've also made them not to have too many carbohydrates. And so they take a lot of this into account, those 150 recipes. So that can be another great guide to have on hand if you want a lot more detailed information. Okay, so that's really the best thyroid diet. The way to support the this podcast is to subscribe on iTunes, and please rate it and review it. It's also found on Google Play Podcasts now and Stitcher and places like that. Go to drhedberg.com, and I have a few articles on the thyroid diet, and there's some more links and resources there. And hope you enjoyed this. This is Dr. Hedberg, and I will talk to you at the next podcast. Take care.